So we're going to read from Matthew chapter 5, verse 38. The first book of the New Testament, Matthew's Gospel, chapter 5, verse 38. Let's hear God's word together. You have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if someone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be the sons of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your brothers, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. It was an evening in November. Suddenly shouts lit up the silence. We had attacked. We the slaves, we the dung underfoot, we the animals with patient hooves. We were running like madmen. Shots rang out. We were striking. Blood and sweat cooled and refreshed us. A great clamor arose. It was the outhouses burning, and the flames flickered sweetly on our cheeks. Then was the assault made on the master's house. They were firing from the windows. We broke the doors. The master's room was wide open. The master's room was brilliantly lighted. And the master was there, very calm. Our people stopped dead. It was the master. I went in. It's you, he said, very calm. It was I. Even I. And I told him so. The good slave, the faithful slave, the slave of slaves. And suddenly his eyes were like two cockroaches frightened in the rainy season. I struck. And the blood spurted. And that is the only baptism that I remember today. Powerful prose of Aimé Césaire in a novel written some years ago. It's a novel which seeks to unfold to us the psychological emancipation which violence seems at least to offer to the oppressed. But in doing so, I think that piece of writing also highlights the moral ambiguity in revenge. The trouble with revenge is it doesn't feel like a sin, does it? The trouble with revenge is that it feels like justice. It doesn't feel dirty. It feels, as that piece of prose says, cathartic. As Aimé Césaire's rebel slave so eloquently terms it, it feels like a baptism. Who hasn't experienced that baptism? The satisfying, cleansing, renewing relief that you feel when you come to the end of the movie and the hero finally catches up with the villain and administers that recompense of suffering and death which after an hour and a half we know he so richly deserves. Whether it is Clint Eastwood in some spaghetti western, or Bruce Lee in some martial arts spectacular, whether it's Rambo settling old scores in Vietnam, or the Ninja Turtles combating Shredder in the sewers of New York. The message is really always fundamentally the same, isn't it? Good conquers evil by violence. And that's okay, because when right is on your side, revenge is not only sweet, it is just. That's the trouble with revenge. It doesn't feel like a sin. It feels like justice. But is it as simple as that? A recent film that puts a very thought-provoking question mark against the naive morality of revenge was Martin Scorsese's Cape Fear. In that film, Robert De Niro plays a man who is obsessed with revenge. So obsessed, he actually has a Bible verse we just read in that passage tattooed on his body. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But this man is not righteous. This man is terrifyingly vicious and indisputably criminal. In the final scene, he drowns in floodwaters like some latter-day representative of pre-diluvian savagery. It is an extraordinarily ironic reversal of our normal Hollywood expectations. We are glad this time that vengeance has not triumphed. The world feels more wholesome, more clean, for having been purged of this self-appointed nemesis. He may have had Matthew 5 engraved on his heart, but he was wrong, nevertheless. Just as Shylock was wrong when he demanded his pound of flesh in Shakespeare's great and classic study of revenge, Merchant of Venice. Now, revenge may feel like justice, but a lot of the time it is the very opposite. It may feel cathartic, but a lot of the time it is defiling. Revenge may feel like a divine baptism, but a lot of the time it is in fact a demonic cesspool in which anger and bitterness consume men and women to their own self-destruction. How do we disentangle, then, this moral ambiguity that surrounds revenge? How do we distinguish that legitimate vengeance which seeks to see evil justly punished and that illegitimate vengeance which threatens to tear us apart with uncontrolled violence and passion? And I think it's precisely that question Jesus is trying to address in these verses of the Sermon on the Mount we're studying this morning. There are two things we need to understand by way of background to these verses. The first is that they are addressed to a society that wanted revenge, and wanted it very deeply. Rather like the situation of colonial oppression, which Aimé Césaire describes in that novel we began with. The Jews of Jesus' day were oppressed by a foreign power. They may not have been slaves exactly, but they were not far short of being so. They had no political independence, they were economically exploited, and the iron fist of Roman tyranny crushed the slightest murmurings of nationalist ambition. Deep in the heart of every first century Jew, there was a profound hatred of these pagan imperialists who so cruelly tyrannized them. They wanted revenge. More than that, the second thing we need to understand is that Jesus is addressing here a society which, rather like Robert De Niro in Cape Fear, felt virtuous in its desire for revenge. They were convinced that the retaliation they sought to inflict upon their Roman overlords was noble and just, for did not the Bible tell them so? Two verses in particular, it seems, were commonly quoted in support of their position. The first, which comes several times in the Old Testament, in Exodus and Deuteronomy, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Which they took to mean that everybody has the right to strike back when somebody abuses them. The second, from Leviticus, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. which the rabbis interpreted to mean, you are at liberty to hate anybody who isn't your neighbor, especially those who you count your enemies, like Romans, for instance. So can you imagine the stunned disbelief of Jesus' audience when they hear these words that Matthew has recorded here in chapter 5 from Jesus' lips? Jesus is telling us, telling this oppressed people who wanted revenge, this oppressed people who admired revenge and who had Bible texts to justify revenge, he's telling them that revenge is wrong. That there is something fundamentally sub-Christian and godless about it. Just look at these astonishing little scenarios that he paints for us in these verses to illustrate just how radical his renunciation of the vengeful spirit is. First, he gives us a picture of public insult. Suppose somebody strikes you on the right cheek, he says. By specifying the right cheek, Jesus is highlighting the humiliating nature of the gesture. This is, he has in mind that the backhanded slap across the face, which in Eastern culture was regarded as a particularly withering affront to a person's honor and dignity. How do you respond to such an insult? Asked Jesus. Everything within us shouts, of course, hit him back, punch him in the eye. An eye for an eye. But no, says Jesus. My command is unclench your fist. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. Then he paints a little picture of a situation of litigation in court. Somebody's suing you for damages, and so implacable are they in their pursuit of compensation, they are determined to quite literally have the shirt off your back. What do you do in such circumstances? Asks Jesus. Everything within you says, hire a better lawyer. File a counter-petition. Get his shirt off his back for slander and false accusation. But Jesus says, no. My command is, settle out of court. If someone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. Then he gives a particularly difficult picture for the Jew. A picture of bullying victimization. Here's a Roman soldier. He encounters you on the street and he commandeers you to carry his load, his heavy load, 1,000 paces, a Roman mile. See, the Roman law entitled him to do this. But you can just imagine how those patriotic Jews resented it. How do you respond when a soldier commandeers you like that? Asked Jesus. Everything within you says, count out those statutory 1,000 paces with pedantic accuracy, and when you get to the 1,000th, drop that bag of his in the nearest ditch and stick out your tongue at him. An eye for an eye. Jesus says, no. My command is, go on counting a bit longer, or better still, don't start counting at all. If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Then fourthly, there is this situation of financial need. Somebody is in financial trouble and they ask for your help. Maybe it's just a beggar on the street asking you for the price of a drink. Maybe it's a colleague at work asking you for the loan of a tenner till payday. Or some commentators think that what Jesus has in mind here is the situation where somebody actually owes you money already, and he's having difficulty paying it back. But whatever the situation is, you feel reluctant to be generous. Maybe this guy wasn't there when you were down on your luck. Did he put money in your pocket when you were broke? No, everything within you is telling you, you don't owe this person anything. Tell him to get lost. Tell him you want your money back with interest. Treat him the same way he treats you. That says Jesus, no. In such a situation, my command is, be generous. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Then finally, to cap it all, he presents us with this general situation of personal animosity. You have an enemy. Maybe he or she is a personal enemy, somebody who has injured you as an individual. Or maybe he or she is a class or race enemy, a representative of a social group who has treated your people with cruelty or oppression, as the Romans had the Jews. Either way, there is a wall of hostility between you. What do you do in that situation? Everything within you says, hate. Reserve your affection and your kindness for your friends and your family and the people who are kind to you. Love your neighbor, but hate your enemy. Jesus says, no. My command is that you treat them kindly. If they persecute you, nevertheless, you pray for them. If they cold shoulder you in the street, you nevertheless greet them courteously. I tell you, he says, love your enemies. Put it all together, and these have to be among the most revolutionary words Jesus ever spoke, don't they? In fact, arguably, they are among the most revolutionary words anybody has ever spoken. And who can doubt that the world would be a different place if the world embraced them? It's not hard, is it, to see how much violence and misery is engendered in our world today by the desire for revenge upon enemies. Mr. Hume, we're told, has a new initiative on Ireland. Will it even be considered by militant Protestants, I wonder? Yasser Arafat and Mr. Rabin have shaken hands at the White House. But will their peace talks make any difference to hardline Palestinians and Jews, I wonder? Dr. Owen tells us they are nearer to a settlement in the former Yugoslavia than ever before, or they were, until the most bloody atrocity of the entire war was committed by a group of Bosnian Muslims last week. In South Africa, the sanctions are being lifted. Apartheid is as good as over. But will that new constitution ever be decided? While right-wing extremists and Inkatha continue their vendetta against the ANC? And here in Britain, in the east end of London, we have racial violence erupting in Brick Lane and a racist council elected. Who can doubt the relevance of Jesus' words? He wants to erase that vindictive tattoo from Robert De Niro's back and replace it with a new text of his own. No longer an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. No, love your enemies. What a happy place this world would be if only we did. And yet, as we said at the beginning, it isn't as simple as that, is it? For the cry that goes up in Northern Ireland and in Palestine and in Bosnia and in South Africa and yes, even in Bethnal Green is not, we want revenge. The cry that goes up is, we want justice. That's the trouble with revenge. It doesn't feel like a sin. It feels like justice. How do you distinguish the vice from the virtue in this matter? That's the difficult thing, isn't it? Let's see if we can dispel a bit of the confusion and get to grips with what Jesus is saying in these verses. First of all, let me say this. I don't think Jesus is encouraging us in these verses to make fools or martyrs of ourselves. If you're like me, when you read those verses about turn the other cheek and so on, a whole host of protests arise in your mind at the practical implications of such sentiments. Jesus, we want to say, if I turn the other cheek, as you suggest, I'll simply be letting people rub my nose in the dirt all the time. If I refuse to defend myself in court, I'll simply be as good as pleading guilty to any charge that's laid against me. If I go the extra mile in the way you suggest, it's an open invitation to be used and put upon by other people. And frankly, to shell out money whenever I'm asked for it is the quickest route to bankruptcy I know. This open-hearted, no-revenge policy of yours sounds all very nice in theory, but Jesus, taken literally, It plays into the hands, surely, of every unscrupulous bully and beggar in the country. You can't be serious, Jesus. And I have to say, to a degree, I think such protests are justified, and I don't believe Jesus would have resisted them. Jesus' words here do need careful interpretation if they're not to lead to ridiculous and dangerous conclusions, and I'm sure Jesus would have been the first to admit so. For he's engaging here in what's technically called hyperbole. Hyperbole is the deliberate overstatement or exaggeration of a point in order to reinforce its rhetorical impact. And you know that preachers do it all the time. It is the lousy preacher who kills his sermon by the death of 1,000 qualifications. Every preacher worth his stuff overstates and lets you meet him at the door for those details, nuances that you really want on his finer points. Jesus knows, as well as you and I do, that if a mugger confronts you in the street with a knife in his hand, you have a perfect right to defend yourself. You don't just have to stand there and let him stab you. Similarly, Jesus knows perfectly well that if you and I were to give a pound to every homeless person that encountered us on the streets of Cambridge, we would simply be enriching the publicans and drug dealers of this city most of the time and not doing the cause of homelessness any good at all. It's impossible to believe, then, that Jesus is encouraging us to be naive or supine in that kind of way when confronted by wicked or exploitative people. He certainly wasn't naive or supine himself when he was confronted by wicked or exploitative people, and neither were the apostles. No, these cameos are deliberately exaggerated to make them startling, to make them provocative, to make us sit up and think, wow, that's new. But he isn't insisting upon a mindless and pedantic observance of these. That would be to make fools and martyrs of ourselves. The second thing I would say by way of observation about these verses is Jesus is not encouraging us to be pacifists or anarchists by these verses. Now, of course, both those philosophies, pacifism and anarchism, do have some support in the church. They have enjoyed support down through the last few hundred years in the church, especially in the Anabaptist tradition. And often these texts are quoted in support of this kind of position. Do not resist the evil person. Turn the other cheek. So it is concluded Christians should never take up arms for their country, Christians should never serve in the police force. All such occupations are disobedient to Jesus' plain command here about resisting the evil. But there is no doubt in my mind that that's to misconstrue Jesus' intention. There are two things that ought to be said in that way, in response to that. The first thing is, it's important to notice here that all the examples Jesus chooses are examples where, as it were, I personally am the object of the victimization. He doesn't say, for instance, if you see somebody mugging an old lady in the street, do not resist the evil person. He doesn't say, if you see someone being unfairly accused in the courts, keep your mouth shut. He would never have said such a thing. It would have been contrary to the whole flow of Scripture to say such a thing. Jesus is illustrating here a willingness to waive our own rights. He's not suggesting that we should be callous or indifferent towards the rights of others. And of course, when we go to war, or when we engage in politics, or when we accept employment as a policeman, it is the rights of others we are primarily seeking to defend, not our own rights. But even beyond that, it's important to realize that Jesus is not contradicting what you can find in other parts of the Bible about the rightful role of civil authority in these verses. Jesus has already told us, remember, back in verse 17, that it's not his intention, by his radical ethics, to contradict the Old Testament law, for instance. On the contrary, his desire has been to see that law fulfilled. Fulfilled in a way that it wasn't being fulfilled by the scribes and the Pharisees. As we've seen in previous weeks, those of you who've been here, those scribes and Pharisees had a reputation for evading the moral force of God's law while technically obeying the strict letter of it. And this text, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, was a rather classic example of that. For you see, in its original context, in Exodus 21 or in Deuteronomy 19, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was a direction to the magistrates of Israel. It was a direction about the penalty to be imposed in the case of grievous bodily harm. It's a judicial regulation. It required the magistrates to see to it that convicted offenders were punished in a way that was consistent and proportional to the seriousness of their crime. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. What the scribes and Pharisees had done with this ancient law of retribution was to turn it into a pretext for private revenge. If somebody hurts you, you have a God-given right to hit them back. That's what they took it to mean. But if you think about it, that's the very opposite of the intention of God's law as it was originally given. But the whole point about the law was that God took the right of revenge, of vengeance away from the individual and invested it in the judiciary. He did that because he knew that personal revenge is a passionate, ill-disciplined thing. It always punishes beyond the desert of the crime, and not infrequently it seizes the innocent with the guilty. So God appointed civil authorities so that revenge should not explode in that lawless way, but that in a calm and objective manner, wise and just men should see to it that every person has a fair trial, and if they're found guilty, that they are punished in a fair and proportionate way. That's the true meaning of this word, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. God has given authority to the civil courts to execute justice in a dispassionate way. We are not empowered to take revenge for ourselves. If we have been offended, it is their job to see justice done. Far from contradicting the Old Testament law, then, in what Jesus says here about eye for an eye and a tooth for tooth, he is actually reaffirming the true thrust of those ancient words by once again insisting that there is no right for private revenge. Such acts are not permissible. It is not God's way. But in no way is it to be understood as embracing pacifism or anarchism. He would have agreed with the Old Testament principle that there is a legitimate use of force by the state in defense of justice. That's why he never told the Roman centurions to resign their commission. That's why he never questioned the authority of Pilate to try him on a capital charge. On the contrary, he actually told Pilate that that civil authority he exercised as judge had been mandated to him by God himself. So Jesus isn't encouraging us to make fools or martyrs of ourselves. He isn't encouraging us to be indifferent to the exploitation of the weak. And he isn't advocating pacifism or anarchism. What then is he doing in these controversial verses? I suggest to you it can be put in two words. He is encouraging us to have a forgiving heart, a forgiving spirit. It's as simple as that. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you, love your enemies. See, the scribes and the Pharisees had done with this Old Testament law just as they'd always done, argued around it. It was they who added that second phrase. The Old Testament doesn't say, love your neighbor, but hate your enemy. It just says, love your neighbor as yourself. That bit, hate your enemy, is a gloss by the rabbis. In their typical way, they had asked the question, well, who is my neighbor then? And they had decided the answer was, your neighbor is your friend, your neighbor, your kinsman, your fellow Jew. Love your neighbor, but hate your enemy. To that Jesus says now, we may not narrow the definition of neighbor in that way, he says, on racist grounds or any other kinds of grounds. Your neighbor is simply that other human being whose life intersects your own. Jew or Gentile makes no odds. This them-us distinction between neighbors and enemies is a false dichotomy. The law of God requires us to love irrespective of race or color or status. Irrespective, indeed, of how people regard us. So I tell you, love your enemies. And it's surely against that background that these extraordinary little cameos that Jesus has painted for us are to be understood and applied. Of course, if you push them to their pedantic limit, it's not difficult to show how Jesus' words about turning the other cheek and so on can lead to all kinds of unfairness. Criminals would commit their crimes with impunity because policemen were turning the other cheek. The litigious would always win their cases because everybody would be giving them their cloaks. Bullies would never be opposed because everybody would be going the extra mile. And the irresponsibly, the financially irresponsible would be unfailingly rewarded for their prodigality because everybody would be giving them handouts. Jesus does not intend us to throw out the baby with the bathwater in that reckless way. He's not suggesting that we abandon our common sense or that we abandon our concern for justice and fair play in society. But what he is insisting upon in these provocative pictures is a forgiving spirit. He's trying to enable us, you see, to see the difference between revenge and justice. A distinction which I'm afraid the scribes and the Pharisees were blind to. The trouble with revenge is it feels like justice. And the trouble with the scribes and the Pharisees was they interpreted revenge as justice. But Jesus puts them in two different camps. No, he says, if you are my disciple, you must display a forgiving heart. A heart which harbors no vindictive hostility to others, which knows how to diffuse a situation of provocation by meekness and non-aggression. A heart that doesn't need to be forever standing on its rights, that would rather settle at terms disadvantageous to itself rather than engage in endless bitter recriminations. A heart that harbors no grudges, that is above petty spite, that doesn't have to be uncooperative or awkward or work to rule in order to show how it wants to get its own back on the boss. A heart that is inclined to charity, never mean-minded, never selfish, never unsympathetic to the needs of others, even if they are the needs of people who owe us less than nothing. Such a forgiving heart, Jesus commands. Love your enemies, he says. Oh, of course there may be times when you have to fight back. There may be times when you have to go to court. There may be times when you have to say no to people. And if you didn't, you'd just create a world in which everyone would be trampled on by selfishness and exploitation all the time. Jesus knows that as well as you and I do. He wouldn't deny it. But he is illustrating for us here in stark and shocking terms what it means nevertheless to love. To love all, irrespective of who they are or how they've treated you. This is not sentimental eyewash, this love your enemies thing. It's not a strategy of emotional manipulation like Gandhi's non-violence in India was. This is not even just a moral duty, says Jesus. This is a spiritual witness. Do you see how he puts it? Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be the sons of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If God never tempered his justice with mercy, whatever would have become of us? But he blends the two constantly with a peculiar genius that belongs to him alone. He sends the blessing of sunshine and rain on good and bad without discrimination, says Jesus. And if we want to be his children, if we want to aim at the moral perfection he represents, as opposed to that barren and pedantic perfection the scribes and the Pharisees sought, then we too must know how to set aside our just demands and treat our enemies as our friends. Such behavior, says Jesus, will mark you out as a Christian disciple. Anybody can show the kind of love which restricts its favors to its own friends. That's commonplace. The pagans, the tax collectors love like that. You're not doing anything very special if you only love people who love you. The children of God betray their family likeness to their father by this remarkable distinctive. They love their enemies. And that is why, of course, they are the vanguard of a new world altogether. I guess even if you haven't read the book, you've seen the film Ben-Hur. Lew Wallace's story is well worth reading in the original if you've never done it. For in a way, it bears comparison with that novel by Aimé Césaire I began by quoting. Ben-Hur, too, was a slave. Though a noble Jew by birth, he had been falsely accused and condemned to serve as an oarsman in a Roman galley. His property had been confiscated. His beloved mother and sister were walled up in a prison where they contract leprosy. Ben-Hur, then, rather like Robert De Niro in Cape Fear, is obsessed with the desire for revenge, consumed by it. And in many respects, he wins revenge over his enemies, defeating them by means of his athletic excellence and his courage in the Roman arena, that famous chariot race. And yet, strangely, revenge doesn't satisfy him. He is an embittered and a cynical and dissatisfied man. Then one day, he sees a man carrying a cross up a hill in his own hometown of Jerusalem. He watches as they drive nails through the man's hands. And to his amazement, he hears him say, "Father, forgive them." He watches while they lift the cross against the darkened sky. He watches while Jesus dies. And the experience transforms his life. "I looked into his eyes," he says, "and those eyes took the sword out of my hand." There is a better way to conquer evil than revenge. Our revenge may feel like justice, taste like justice, but it is not. For you see, the way that evil and hatred grows in this world is very often precisely by revenge, by reciprocal rebounding actions. One man insults another man, the other man insults the first man, but louder. The first man hits the second man hits the first man, but harder. The first man takes out a knife, the second man takes out a gun, bang, bang. That's how it happens. That's how it happens in Northern Ireland, in Bosnia, in South Africa, in the Middle East, in East London. That's how it happens. This is how evil grows in the world, on the principle of revenge, parading as justice. And the only way to stop such evil is by breaking that vicious cycle. "Do not be overcome by evil," says the apostle. Overcome evil with good. That's exactly what we see Jesus doing. He took the evil of the world, and like a shock absorber riding over the bumps on the road, he absorbed it. He absorbed its impact into himself. And there was no recoil. It was completely absorbed within his loving and forgiving heart. And if we would be the children of God, if we would help him build the kingdom of which he is the founder, we must learn to love and to forgive too. Let's pray together.